Hi, everyone. This is Lynn Harder, co-producer and host of Defining Moments podcast. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I hope you're ready to lean in and listen, really listen, as I'm joined by Dr. Olivia McInerlin. Olivia is the co-director of the Virtual Reality and Nature Lab at Clemson University and creator of Tandem VR. Tandem VR is a shared virtual reality experience that reconnects people with meaningful places. Her work brings together storytelling and virtual reality to help people revisit cherished memories and create new ones. At the heart of this episode is an article authored by Olivia in Health Communication titled, "It Feels Really Vulnerable and a Little Dangerous When Words Are Not Enough. Whenever a manuscript arrives on my desk, I'm optimistic the work will be original. I hope it will change how I see things, offer new ways of thinking and feeling, stimulate new ways of being in the world." Olivia's essay does just that. She reflects on her work with individuals with end-stage chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. In many cases, people living with severe COPD are sheltered from nature due to their disease state. Through a collaborative process with participants, Olivia recreates nature-based experiences using 360 technology. In doing so, she engages in a process she describes as re-gifting, the act of giving back a moment a person has previously experienced. Olivia, thank you for your life-enhancing work, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi, it is lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Olivia, I want to start by going back a bit in time. You earned a PhD from Clemson University in Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Management. What led you to pursue this work?
I think that is a great place to start because people are often surprised when they hear about this work, mm-hmm. that it comes from a Parks and Rec and Tourism degree. Mm-hmm. So I came to Clemson with the sole purpose and hope of joining the Virtual Reality and Nature Lab at Clemson as a graduate student, mainly because the focus of the lab in general was that nature is not a nice to have, but a need to have for everyone. And we're taking nature as an actual physical nature walking outside to having some sort of virtual simulated interpretation of nature. Mm. My past work in my master's was actually an ethnographic study of co-ed hiking groups. And it really drew me to the struggle that I was studying. I was in a group and I was experiencing nature firsthand, beautiful places. And I just did not feel comfortable as a woman within that group. Mm. And it led me to see what, if those possibilities are already limited for myself, let's think about the populations who don't even feel safe or comfortable being outdoors. How are they even getting nature when we realize that nature has so many health benefits? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So my background is in a very fun combination, cross-disciplinary all the way, in exercise science, kinesiology, psychology. Mm. But I think what drew all of these together was I wanted to do work, and still to this day, want to do work that brings nature to people who don't feel comfortable or safe with the usual forms of nature around them or what they typically feel like they have access to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Olivia, that is fascinating. And I want to repeat back to you something I heard you say. Nature is a need to have. Nature is a need.
That, yes.
I mean, that is, it's really profound. It's incredibly profound. Part of what I find so provocative about your work related to nature and recreation and exercise kinesiology is the storytelling component. Can you lean into that and talk to us about how you approach these natural experiences from a narrative perspective?
Yes, I love this question. A lot of times people ask us how we create an experience in virtual space. How do you go from having a camera that takes 360 videos. So then being able to put a traditional VR headset, the fancy word is head-mounted display or HMD. How do you go from having the equipment to having a finished product? And the thing that we that ties all of these parts together is story. Mm-hmm. We're making decisions. And I say we as in me, if I am trying to capture something for myself, which I have done before to try to preserve a memory, I am making decisions based on the lived experiences I've had, the stories that I've told. What about those memories reach out and just capture me and why I love this place so much and what I would want in a dream VR experience. So a lot of it is working, having the privilege of working with people, getting comfortable with each other, and then being able to hear stories and trying to bring those visually and auditorily to life. And it is not the easy task, but it's always rewarding. And it's also always surprising.
I think it's a gift when the work that we choose to do, if we have that privilege, allows us to be surprised, allows us to explore new places and to do that based on the memories of another that they grant us the privilege of sharing.
And I think the granting part is the key part of what changes when you think of research as, I don't know, traditionally transactional. I do this thing for you, you reap health benefits, ta-da, close circle, we are done. That is not what Tandem VR, what our co-designed virtual reality experiences are. It's almost like a iterative process where I am never talking to somebody one time, capturing a story and then disappearing to go virtually create it. It's always an ongoing conversation mm-hmm. that brings me closer to people. And the beautiful part is as I get to know people more, families more, caregivers more, it also allows me to deepen the quality and the choices made in the VR simulations to make it resonate more with them as people, as I get to know them and walk in their memories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One thing I hold true is that the worlds we inhabit are built of natural environments, nature, mm-hmm. human design spaces, and stories. So I appreciate how your storytelling work is guided by an acute sense of place and how place is integral to our autobiographical memories.
Mm-hmm.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned, Tandem VR.
Yes.
Talk to us, for listeners who haven't read your article and are unfamiliar, this is a trademark process that you've developed. Can you talk to us about Tandem VR and the Virtual Reality and Nature Lab at Clemson University?
Yes. If you have a chance to read about David and Anne, David is the precursor, the jumping off point to Tandem VR. Tandem VR, the heart of it is that it's a VR experience that you do with at least two people and you're in an immersive environment together. And just to back up a little bit on the techiness, virtual reality is often something where you put a headset on and you're like you're by yourself in your own world. Tandem VR sees the potential of how when you combine storytelling and also social connection, magical things can happen. So if Lynn and I wanted to go to my favorite place and I wanted to kind of share who I was, I'm a very topophilia, it's that environmental psychology term that you feel your soul in a place, I might introduce myself in Tandem VR by showing us together, each in our own headsets, what Acadia National Park looks like in Maine. Maine is where I grew up. Acadia National Park, Sand Beach is almost a year ago. I got married there. It drives me rocky coastlines. Oh, I'm going back next month and I cannot wait. But Tandem VR allows us to be in that space together and have these conversations. So it's all about sharing experiences with each other in tandem, so at the exact same time. This is done through a in-house virtual reality and nature lab created tool by doctoral student candidate Dr. Fooley, or Mr. Fooley, at Clemson. It's called Echosphere. And it means that Colin, the producer on this show, could be holding a tablet while Lynn and I are just able to converse with our headsets on and feel like we are in Acadia. And it's always, the heart of Tandem VR is that it's always personalized. There's an authentic choice. I'm not saying, oh, Lynn loves the beach, I'm just going to pull up a beach video. It's asking a lot of deeper questions about, I don't know, maybe what resonates with her about water locations. What does she imagine when she thinks of a beautiful space, and building off of that instead of prescriptively assuming that there'd be health benefits from showing you a sandy beach in Florida, for example.
Olivia, I want to go to Maine with you.
We should road trip.
Let's do it.
We could road trip in the headsets. I know sometimes I, with some of our grad students in the lab, as a way to get to know each other, we sometimes show each other different clips or things from, I don't know, our life experiences. It was very, I don't know, a profound experience to sit with graduate students as they sorted out moving to the U.S. from the different places that they lived outside of the U.S. and being able to not just hear about the name of a country, but be able to see maybe what their childhood looked like. It just deepens people's connections, even if you don't know each other very well.
Yeah. I think your work vividly illustrates something that narrative scholars really grasp, and that is that storytelling renders places meaningful, even as places offer the parameters that give rise to storytelling. That places are both material, physical, and culturally and personally defined by our lived experiences.
100%. And I would say the more time that I spend going down these rabbit holes, co-creating, hearing stories, the more that it changes how I perceive place in my everyday life. I think it has almost a reflective or iterative process that as I'm studying, as I'm learning, experiencing people's idea of place and identity, that place and identity is equally changing me and I'm feeding into it. And it's a beautiful chaotic sort of mess. To sift through.
Okay, this is going to sound somewhat random, but I'm going to share it with you anyway. Last night, my husband and I ordered in Chinese, and my fortune cookie was, you will discover a new passion exploring a new place.
Whoa.
Right? And I thought that was sort of divine, given that I knew we were going to be talking. It also led us to talk about our shared love of travel. I think travel always encourages me to see things with new eyes. And yet, what your work teaches us is that seeing anew can happen anywhere. So the back roads that I walk on, right, every day, I try to experience that as a new place because I try to see and hear something that I might not have paid attention to the day before. And of course, things inherently change because of the impermanence of our world. And so what you're doing through storytelling and technology and connecting it to places is really transporting participants from the here and now to other settings, to other places, moving between the not anymore and the not yet. So it's not just a revisiting of a previous memory. You're creating a new one because that place and that person doesn't stand still.
Yes. I think a lot of the times I interact with people and they assume that I am trying my very best to recreate a memory in someone's head. And I know even with all of the sources, even with all of the resources in the world, it would be a failure to try to recreate 100% something somebody already experienced. To be able to get to that next level, that as stories change, as we continue to tell them, as we continue to share them, I have a really, I don't know, a comical example of researcher, I guess, bias. And in that, and it makes me think of it based on what you just said. And it started from the heart of, oh, I should give auditory tracks because in VR, you can see things, move up and down, move your head left to right. And it's a 360 image that moves with you. But the audio also will move with you. And we'll play. And I always did audioscapes. I still do to this day based on what people's memories are. And it would be shocking the number of people who say, oh yeah. And then there's this peace. There's a peaceful water sound almost. And sometimes we're in a field. There is no, if you just looked visually, me as a researcher or an audio track producer, just looking at a film, I would never in 100 years put in water sounds because there's no water present. But to live in the memories of these people's places where memories and days sort of start to swirl and mix together, water sounds is a part of that environment and that place. So let's put it in there and let's see how having a conversation like that continues to change the decisions I help create from the tech perspective, but also how you keep reimagining the place and talking about it with your family.
And that depends on an acute sense of listening on your part, really listening and hearing what matters to people and how they share that.
It listening, I think my parents would probably say has not always been childhood Olivia's strongest point. but I think that the more we as researchers, we as people in leadership positions, power of any sort, can sit back and let others speak up and share their stories and say, am I interpreting this right when you said X? I think it creates a better, at least a better virtual reality experience.
Couple that with the end of life circumstances that you've chosen to journey on with others. And I think that this is of particular interest to Defining Moments listeners. The article that is accessible, that accompanies this podcast, focuses on two individuals, one of whom is experiencing end-stage COPD. Wondering if you can talk to us about the nature of COPD and why it's particularly well-suited for nature-based virtual reality experiences.
Severe COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease just makes life incredibly difficult. The heart of COPD is that it makes breathing really difficult. And as humans, you pretty much have to breathe all the time whenever you're doing anything. So for some people, severe COPD makes it so there's just fatigue. For others, and that's why they don't feel like they can adventure outside their home. For others, it's not just the breathing difficulty, but also potentially the social stigma, the looks from having to carry around oxygen tanks, and the pre-planning to go on something like a trip, to be able to jump, because I'm in South Carolina right now, to be able to get on a plane in Greenville, South Carolina, and get to Maine to go see Acadia, it seems insurmountable based on all the planning and preparation. And oftentimes you need to set up physician visits in the place you're visiting. It creates a hugely complicated barrier that for many, those barriers are lessons if they choose not to leave their homes. So lack of homes means probably most likely lack of being able to see the places that they love, which is kind of what drew me to working with people with chronic disease, but especially severe COPD.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That makes sense. Storytellers are always preoccupied by place. The heart of stories are movement across time and place, right? And connecting people through the process of emplotment. And it strikes me that place takes on a heightened significance for people like David and Anne, who are facing precarious circumstances, right? And place becomes inaccessible due to physical constraints. Unless somebody like you, Olivia, allows them to experience that in a different way.
I would say that a lot of people think about this and they think of revisiting photo albums, and VR in some ways is almost a more immersive version of a photo album to revisit ideas.
Hi folks, this is Lynn breaking in for just a second. We've been talking to Olivia McInerlin about her use of 360 virtual reality to connect people with cherished places in nature they are unable to visit due to COPD. For your convenience, we've placed links to her recently published article in Health Communication on our Facebook page. We've also included a link to her virtual nature lab, Tandem VR. Okay, back to the conversation. Yeah, virtual reality storytelling is uniquely equipped in its capacity to immerse audiences in the sights and the sounds of a scene where participants kind of have a heightened sense of being there, right? As if they're physically present. So it places people in the center of that story, if you will. So I hope that you can walk us through kind of step by step the process by which you do that. And in the article, you talk about this journey with David and his wife and caregiver, Anne. David's an avid kayaker and adrenaline junkie. Mm-hmm. Prior to his diagnosis, he loved motorcycles, whitewater rafting. Near the end of David's life, you created a personalized VR experience with him and Anne. Walk us through how you did that.
Yeah, and this story is always going to be a little harder to talk about because this is also a story about two people that deeply love each other during the processes of death and dying. But I will start by saying that I met David and he had more life and life experiences than I think maybe the typical person. Just because of all of the things he told me that he had done in his early adulthood that were filled with adrenaline that I would never want to do as a person, not even with a helmet on, when it comes to motorcycling. I think there was a quote where he told me pretty much anything with an engine, I would ride it pretty much anywhere over anything. Nope, not me. So I think the first part of this is meeting David and Anne and quickly realizing that I didn't resonate with his life experiences of being an adrenaline junkie, but I resonated with the fact that he felt so tied to upstate South Carolina, which is near where Clemson is based, and how he hadn't seen so many of these places or had these experiences. Due to severe COPD. So there were a lot of conversations a lot of my other people that I met with during this time, because I did three other projects like this to come together to create a dissertation, I was able to do home visits. Mm. Phone calls are often really tricky if you have severe COPD, because breathing and having to articulate yourself on the phone can just be really hard. But almost all of David and Anne's experiences were done through video chats, actually, because at this time, there was still a worry about COVID. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with his disease state, there was just a worry about transmitting germs, and I did not want to bring more germs into their home. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of video calling and a lot of storytelling of all of these wild, amazing experiences he had had. All the times that Anne and I both said, that sounds terrifying. But also so many beautiful memories of David and Anne saying, well, we love this place because this is where we go on dates. Or when he wasn't doing these wild things, Olivia, like, this is where we would go to be together outside. And there was something really beautiful about that. So I was able to be their boots on the ground, and we had several conversations before we narrowed it down to, I think, 4 to 6 places. Like actual location places. Like one of them, for example, is the South Carolina Botanical Gardens. Mm. One of them is Saw Ram Park, which is where the Whitewater Rapids are. And I had boots on the ground, and I went to go see if I'd be able to capture a 360 video for a high quality VR experience. Mainly that, like, the pond they talk about, the South Carolina Botanical Gardens, still exists. That some of these bigger landmark things maybe have changed a little bit, but they're essentially still there. Hmm. Because the last time they'd been able to visit some of these places and together had been 5 to 10 years. In 5 to 10 years for Anne as well, because Anne, as the informal caregiver, wasn't able to leave David's side. So I think it's important to think of this unit, this is a gift for David, but in some ways it catapulted the idea of Tandem VR as being a gift for more than one person, because when you're an informal caregiver, that is your identity and that is your life. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go to a lot of places that I didn't know very well. I had only been to touristy places, but I started kind of going down roads that I honestly did not know if there were really roads in South Carolina. Dirt roads that led to places that were exciting and led to some of David and Anne's memories together. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So after realizing that 4 of those places were viable, meaning that they were authentic, I sent pictures to David and Anne, still shots, to make sure that this is the place that they wanted. These are the angles. I went and used our 360 camera, and we did a sequencing of collecting all the data, collecting all the scenes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of the fun facts is I actually did this over the course of a week with my dad. He had come down specifically to be my, I think he called it a camera Sherpa, because there's so much equipment involved and there were some places where we had to hike in.
Yeah.
So there's something very special about having this be a family affair all around. Mm. Mm. I don't know how often we talk in health communications about getting family involved in our research processes, but it was a experience we still talk about, collecting these stories and having him live through these places as well. Mm-hmm. So after all the clips were collected, all these video clips, David and Anne got to see their clips. They got to be the storytellers, the videographers, sound engineers. They were given total control on what clips stayed, what clips went, the order, and then also the audio. So I tried to give as much choice into what they would want to experience again as possible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that process took a little bit maybe a couple of weeks. And during this process, David's health just continued to decline. He was hospitalized several times. There were a lot of calls to Anne and the nurse practitioner asking if they still wanted to proceed. And David and Anne kept saying, yes, we need this. We want this. We want to visit these places one more time together. Because they knew that David was going into hospice and that likely he would end up passing away several weeks later. And I think that was one of the hardest things about this process is that I went into it seeing severe COPD. Okay, they're in palliative care, they might be in ho at they're at home care. I guess when I started this project, I did not think that I'd be setting foot in a hospice house or a traditional hospice setting. But as his health continued to decline, we checked in with his doctors, his Anne, David, and they continued to say, and it blew my mind. They said, Olivia, if you feel like you can do this, we want you to come visit us. And give this experience. And I don't think that I knew how rewarding, but also how hard that was going to be. So through that process, about a week before David died, I set foot in a hospice house with two VR headsets, visited a room where he had his bed was reclined in a way that he had an outdoor window, but he couldn't really see outside. And I was able to take him to his their favorite place that they like to picnic and people watch in Greenville, South Carolina, the South Carolina Botanical Gardens. And most excitingly, one more rafting trip down Bull's Sluice, which is on the Chattooga River.
What a gift. Or in your language, regift. What a regift for David and Anne. And to you, it sounds like.
I don't think I knew how much this was going to change the course of what I felt like I should be doing or pursuing in my academic life, in my research life, in my person as a person life, thinking about places. Because for a lot of times afterwards, Anne found great comfort in the fact that David smiled during that VR experience and he hadn't smiled since he sat foot into that hospice house.
Let's lean into that. In your essay, which I encourage listeners to read, you are raw and vulnerable and honest about how this experience transformed you as a person and as a researcher. Talk to us a little bit more about that transformation.
I think it's still an ongoing process. I think that it was not my caterpillar to butterfly moment. It was more like the cocoon where I realized this is really important. If we hadn't take the steps to gather these stories, would David have gotten a last nature experience? I honestly don't know. And I think that a lot of times when I tell people that this is the type of work that I do, and it's not always hospice or palliative care, but it's also just regifting virtual experiences, people who just don't feel comfortable or safe visiting some of these spaces. People always say, or not always, but traditionally fall into two buckets. Wow, that's really hard. I don't know how you do this. And it is really hard. But the second thing I love the most is almost everybody, once they hear about Tana VR, David and Anne's story, this work, they say, well, I've always wanted to go back to X place, but I just don't think I'll be able to. Or even it makes me think deeply when people say, I wish my grandmother, father could have experienced fishing one more time, going to X place one more time. And that greatly drives this idea of research not being something that is transactional for me. It's not about getting funding for grants, doing some VR experiences, and then boom, you have a better quality of life. It's about, I don't know, capturing this real human experience of living and memory and nostalgia. I'm somebody who carries a lot of big feelings, a lot of empathy. And I have spent time in my life thinking that could take me out of some conversations or bring me out of some rooms or not feel like I'm being listened to because maybe I'm not articulating in a way that other people feel like they can hear that. But I think embracing this big scariness of empathy and vulnerability when approaching life and research has changed how I mentor students, how I work with participants. I ultimately feel like my truest self when I bring my stories into a research project. And I don't think that type of training usually comes in traditional academic settings or research settings.
Yeah, there can be a disconnect between the language and the rhythms of research and fieldwork and our experiences, particularly walking alongside people in precarious circumstances. Words like attrition that you interrogate, they don't capture the loss of David's life, or that it's possible that David died in a healed state. And Olivia, I want you to know that I see you and I hear you, and I commend you for, in your big feeling way, owning that you can be curious and pursue that curiosity in a rigorous way and in contexts that matter for others, and chart a path to do that, right? Create a path forward that looks a little different than our predecessors.
And I think that I really urge people when I talk about this, and their first response is, that seems really hard. I could never do that. I usually sit with that for a second. In my head, I say, well, I'm not asking you to go volunteer at your local hospice house because that's really hard. But I think that we all have these stories just drive us. And I think the joy of allowing yourself to open up to hear stories in whatever sector you're in, whatever life path you're on, if you start to realize or recognize how much of a privilege that is, your decisions on how you move through life change a lot.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of quotes from your essay that have lingered with me. And truth be told, for those listeners who are not familiar with academic research processes, authors often submit essays for review, in this case, to the journal Health Communication, of which I am one of the senior editors. And senior editors and chief editors assign essays to reviewers, and reviewers read and reflect and offer feedback. Oftentimes, authors then revise and resubmit until ultimately, right, some of those articles are published. When, Olivia, your piece came in, it was not assigned to me. It was assigned to Dr. Jill Yamasaki, and Jill invited me to serve as a reviewer, and I did. And as soon as I hit the button to submit my review, I contacted Jill, and I said, Jill, I want to know who wrote this piece. And of course, she couldn't tell me at the time. But as soon as I served as a reviewer for this piece, I'm like, this is incredibly important work. And so Jill assured me that as soon as this piece was accepted for publication, that she would connect you and I, because she knew I wanted to feature you on Defining Moments. So I was one of the first people to see the initial version of this essay. And in the final version, there's a couple of quotes I want to read to you that just linger with me. First, and this is on page 3. Just as travel leads to stamped passports or mailed postcards, each interaction with a participant leaves a permanent stamp to shape who I am as a co-traveler of precious, intimate, lived experiences. That communicates something incredibly important about your standpoint as somebody who, yes, you're a researcher, but you view yourself as a co-traveler with participants. Also on page 3, in reflecting on David and Anne, this project became a passion project to communicate the loss of David while not letting David and his stories become lost. Olivia, his stories are not lost.
This is very cathartic.
I'm glad.
And it's beautiful to be able to have a conversation that really centers the value of co-traveling and the value of letting things that are scary, like vulnerability, guide research decisions, life decisions. I'm just thankful and still a little bit nervous, honestly, to see this out in the world and to know that some of the quotes, I kind of braced myself because some of the quotes are ultimately pieces of my heart that I'm still wrestling with. I think that in some ways, continuing to connect with people who are nearing end of life or have chronic disease is just a balancing act of feeling so deeply, but also remembering to like self-care for yourself as a person. So I appreciate that resonated with you, because I think deeply about co-traveling a lot. When I'm designing work, when I'm talking to people, when people ask me what I do for a living.
I think it takes a lot of courage to share one's stories. In this case, for participants like David and Anne to share with you, for you to share with readers of Health Communication, for listeners of this podcast, takes courage, because once you share those stories, in Arthur Frank's words, those stories breathe, they move, and they live on in ways that you can never anticipate. And for me, I don't want to live in a world where we do have that control over how people take up a story and make sense with it. And therein lies the vulnerability, because that story is moving in ways that you can never anticipate. So bravo to you for your courage and for walking alongside others in some of the most important journeys of a life, towards the end of a life. And it's not for everybody. It's hard to do. And it's clear in listening to you and in reading your work that you are well suited. You have the capacity to do that well. So thank you.
That is so kind. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I will say that I will applaud listeners who engage with this podcast, because oftentimes when we see words hospice, chronic disease, death, dying, end of life, it can be really hard to sit with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I am just truly thankful when people want to engage with this work and see how it overlays to their experience. It has allowed Tandem VR to not just feel like something that there is a sadness around, but also something that is celebratory and beautiful and impactful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And positive for some people and some families. Mm-hmm. It brings, for some people, some families, it's something that they revisit after their loved one has passed, or they bring back up as a memory that kind of helps sustain people when they're not able to, I don't know, do their bucket list trip to Egypt. They can still think about the time they went to Egypt with our team in virtual reality.
Listeners of this podcast are not going to be surprised to hear me reflect with you that for me, this reveals a false binary that guides so much of how we organize care for those in vulnerable states. Fundamentally believe we have this either or binary between ill and well. And in our work at the med school, in our narrative medicine project called the Open Book Project, what we hope to help future physicians understand is they have the capacity to help others live well amid the inescapable hardship and suffering and trauma of life. It is both and to be able to live well while you are dying, and to be able to help other people in that journey is an incredible gift to them and to you. And it's my understanding, as we look forward to your work, Olivia, that you've recently been involved in a clinical trial where you're looking at how people have experienced this.
Yes, we have a few. This amazingly has grown, and we have a few exciting things up our sleeves. One of them being that we have recently wrapped on a clinical trial for hospice patients and caregivers that is more entwined in their shared experience based on how much Anne and David together gained from going through this process of co-design and co-creation of virtual reality together. So we have data that will be coming out, some exciting research on that for the horizon. We also have, because we are in Clemson, South Carolina, and I don't know who resonates with this, but there is a whole subculture. I was not familiar with it because I'm from the North, of college football and Clemson Tiger football being a thing. And I feel like this is what I should say, go Tigers. And a lot of people that we are working with in the upstate, some of these rural at-home care, told me, Olivia, I just want to be a tiger one more time. And we took that very serious. Mm. So we got support and sign-offs from ESPN and some of the other things that you have to get sign-off when you want to film a college football game. And we were actually able to create the Tana VR Clemson Football Collection, which is a collection of three videos where you can virtually experience one perfect day in Death Valley at the Clemson Stadium. Mm-hmm. And most people will suspect that it is just a bunch of like really impressive gameplay. It's not. It's created with the feedback of people who are no longer able to go to the games. So most of the video is actually created around tailgating, because tailgating is a social experience. If you've not been to the South on a game day, there is dressing up, there is special food, there is special decor. So we do a whole collection on tailgating. The marching band and the music was a big part of this as well as 2 minutes of very exciting game footage that we got approved by ESPN. And we're working on integrating that with reminiscent therapy as a way to sort of give people conduits to tell stories about the times when they were Clemson Tigers. So that is also coming up too.
Ah, girlfriend, you are speaking my language.
You're a football fan?
I am such a football fan. I grew up in rural Nebraska. And thing about rural Nebraska is that there's not a whole lot, right, going on. One thing that unites people across the state of Nebraska is the Cornhusker football team. And in its heyday, which has been a couple decades, they had several national championships. And we still, on game day, turn the lights in our house red and have food from Nebraska, right, that we cherish. And I'll be honest, when I re-engaged her essay, I thought about my dad resting in peace. And I thought about what a beautiful experience it would have been to re-gift him going to Memorial Stadium on a Saturday when Nebraska took on its then rival Oklahoma. And I think what I reflected on, Olivia, is when my dad was in hospice care, I reflected a lot on spatial dynamics, because my daughter was then in elementary school and getting ready to go into middle school. Her world was expanding, right? And my dad's world was shrinking. And I was in the middle, and I was experiencing both of those. And the last week of my dad's life, I saw that world shrink and shrink, right? At the beginning of that week, I was able to take him to Dick's Sporting Goods. And he just looked at guns and ammo because he was an avid hunter. Shrinking. And so to bring it back to what you're doing, I have no doubt that my dad and mom and I would have loved to experience a hunting trip with him or a trip to Memorial Stadium, perhaps taking on Clemson. I have a lot of reverence for the work that you do. I am so excited to see what unfolds next. And Olivia, I'm incredibly grateful that you took time today to share your experiences with us.
It has been lovely to, I think, start a conversation. And I look forward to continuing the conversation with you, Lynn, as well as any of the listeners. We try to stay pretty updated with different projects and different opportunities at our website, which is tandemvr.org. And I also encourage anybody who feels particularly moved, there's a place that you can kind of share your email if you would like to kind of keep up with us more and hear about some of these stories and experiences. We build, we also do a lot of work with just collecting really cool, unique clips with a video lending library. For example, our cameras over winter break went to, I didn't get to go to these places, but our cameras went on a grand trip to Norway, Antarctica, some very unique experiences that help build our library for when people say, I just want one more trip here. Or, ooh, I would love to visit Norway. We help try to make that happen in-house when we can. So if anyone is interested, tandemvr.org is definitely the place to go for more information.
Fantastic. Thanks, Olivia. And thanks, everyone, for joining Dr. McInerlin and I for this episode of the Defining Moments podcast. Defining Moments is produced by WOUB Public Media and the Barbara Gerrards Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact. The Storytelling Institute imagines a world where storytelling creates just and joyful communities. Joe Bianco are co-producers, and Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. You can subscribe to Defining Moments at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the NPR Podcast Directory. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DM Podcast WOUB. On our Facebook page, we'll provide links to Olivia's article published in Health Communication, and we'll also include a link to her virtual nature lab, Tandem VR. We hope you'll take the time to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Thank you, and be well. Thank you.